We turn now from Haiti, a barely functioning state, to places around the world that act like sovereign states but aren't real countries to the rest of the world, places like Kurdistan, Abkhazia, and Somaliland. Atlantic Magazine staff writer Graham Wood says they inhabit a limbo world, well-known but diplomatically unrecognized. Mr. Wood's article on these quasi-states appears in the most recent issue of Foreign Policy magazine. I'm very pleased it brings him back to our show today for our underreported segment. Welcome back to our show.
Thanks for having me.
When you say these places act like sovereign states, what do they do? Would they be functioning in the same way as sovereign states?
There's a wide range of functions that they can occupy, from Taiwan, which has a full military, as well as foreign relations with many different countries, to a much smaller state, which might just have a government, just have a few representatives overseas. But many of these places, when if you were to visit them, would look very much like a normal state. It's just that they don't have recognition universally, or say a seat at the United Nations.
Don't some places like the Armenian separatist enclave in Azerbaijan even issue their own visas with fancy holograms?
That's correct. If you went to the Nagorno-Karabakh Republic in Azerbaijan, which is an Armenian-backed enclave, you would have to get a visa in advance. You would have to go there, and you would have to pay $20 to a representative of the state.
Well,
and that's true of many others: Somaliland, Abkhazia, South Ossetia. They act like states, including in the very small ways that they run their business and allow in foreigners.
Although there's a Potemkin village quality about that, isn't there?
Yes, I mean, what they're doing is, as you say, acting like states first, and so they come up with organs of states that don't exist in the hopes that if they continue to do this, then eventually they'll be treated with the kind of legitimacy that they're putting on a show of at first.
How do the people who live in these places perceive their situation? They're in a situation where their so-called country sees itself as an independent state but has no official diplomatic recognition or a seat at the UN and is considered by most people to be just part of some other place.
Most of the people who live in these places, I find, are very proud of the countries that they live in that don't really exist. The states generally have as their primary goal recognition. And you find that ordinary citizens are very insistent that they live in a country that's just like any other, and that in time the world will recognize it. You find in places like Abkhazia, this is true. They have this pride, although at the same time in Abkhazia, every Abkhazian citizen also has the right to a Russian passport. So even as they're very proud of their statehood, they're often very reliant on other places.
But you say that fake countries like Abkhazia try harder than real ones. You were given personal medical care by the Republic of Abkhazia's health minister while you were visiting, weren't you?
That's right. I had a little accident. I fell and ripped up my leg a bit. And one problem with these states is that they generally don't have the same kind of quality of medical care like many developing countries. And so rather than go to a hospital where, as in a lot of developing countries, people generally go to die, you'd want to find a proper doctor. And just wandering around, I was able to find the Ministry of Health to walk inside to ask for medical help. And before I knew it, the Minister of Health himself was swabbing my leg.
Although he might not have done that if you were just a normal citizen of the so-called Abkhazian country.
No, but like many limbo states, Abkhazia is very, very welcoming to visitors because when foreign visitors come, they bring foreign currency to the country. But they also, by going to the foreign ministry to get their visas, by showing up at all, they lend a certain legitimacy to the state. So you'd find if you went to Abkhazia, Kurdistan, Somaliland, or a lot of other limbo states, that you would probably get very good treatment, not just in relation to the citizens of those limbo states, but in relation to what you would get if you went to a more recognized country.
Well, how do these limbo states like Kurdistan, Somaliland, Abkhazia wind up the way they are today?
Well, they wind up that way, first of all, by a very unpleasant, usually violent process. So Kurdistan ends up that way because it's protected by by U.S., British, and for a while French military forces protecting it from Saddam Hussein. Somaliland ends up that way because it doesn't want to take part in the government of Somalia, because that state's fallen apart. So it's usually through some kind of tragedy that they're entering the world.
Is it significant that Somaliland has taken the name of the British colony that was there before African states gained independence?
The status of Somaliland and the fact that it uses that name, I don't think is especially important. Somaliland, it does indicate the same geographic area that the British occupied rather than the Italians.
Many of the places you write about have colonial legacies. So in most cases, are these quasi-states just places that have always had unique cultural or ethnic distinctions that were just ignored by Europeans who drew up the map? I'm thinking of the zigzag border between Jordan and Saudi Arabia, for example, which has been called Churchill's hiccup because he allegedly was drawing up the map of Transjordan after a large lunch.
Yes, sometimes the carving is a result of a colonial legacy. But you also find states like Abkhazia that it actually did exist as a autonomous region in the early 20th century, and its existence is mostly due to much more recent conflict between the Republic of Georgia and Russia in the post-Soviet era.
Well, a country like Eritrea was also was a colony, a separate colony for a while, but then was incorporated into Ethiopia and fought a war for independence, and in its case, it stopped being a quasi-state.
Yes, and the thing that unifies the quasi-states that I'm referring to in my piece in Foreign Policy is that these states have had this limbo status for quite some time in many cases. Taiwan, which I don't talk about at length, has been for decades a de facto state, but Abkhazia has occupied this status for the better part of almost 20 years. Somaliland the same, and Kurdistan as well. So you find that many of these places, unlike Eritrea, they are in this limbo status and don't really have a pathway to full independence, as Eritrea has achieved and as some others like East Timor have pretty much achieved.
So what has led to this recent phenomenon?
Well, it's partly, as I say, the splintering of the world in the post-Soviet era. I mean, that would explain, for example, the independence movement of Abkhazia or South Ossetia. But apart from that, it's also the examples of one to the others. If you see a country like, or a pseudo-country like Kurdistan, being as successful as it is, that is relatively peaceful for quite some time now, and capable of operating on almost the same footing as a normal state, then it will be very, very encouraging to other states like Abkhazia and South Ossetia. So as one achieves some degree of autonomy, it emboldens the others, and as well as those others that we know about as limbo states now, other rebel movements that aspire to that status.
Kurdistan even has a lobbyist in Washington, Barbara Griffith and Rogers. I'm assuming they're hoping that will help them gain recognition. But the United States supported the Kurds in Iraq while Saddam Hussein was in power. So are these quasi-states also convenient places for other countries to fight proxy wars?
Yes, and that's one of the problems with the existence of these states, is that with almost every quasi-state that I'm referring to, you find that there is another state that is using it as a way to wage its foreign policy against an enemy. So in the case of Kurdistan, as you mentioned, the United States used and was an ally of Kurdistan against Saddam Hussein. But in Abkhazia, South Ossetia, you find as well that Russia has been using these quasi-states to get back at the Republic of Georgia as it has inched closer to the United States and to NATO.
But as far as the Kurds are concerned, Kurdistan is much bigger than just that portion of Iraq. It also goes into Turkey and to Iran. And there are no clients. I mean, there are nobody who wants those areas as clients to encourage a greater Kurdistan being created?
Well, it's very dangerous to encourage the Kurds in those areas, and that's one reason that Kurdistan hasn't achieved full independence, for the obvious reason of it aggravating or angering the Turks, Iranians, and Syrians. But you do see occasionally the suggestion that the Kurds in those other countries that border Iraqi Kurdistan, the suggestion that they be used as allies of the United States or of others to fight against Tehran or to agitate and extract promises from Turkey.
My guest is Graham Wood, staff editor at The Atlantic magazine, but we're talking about an article he wrote for Foreign Policy magazine about quasi-states around the world. Part of our underreported series today. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And as we've been talking, we've discussed how some of these places have actually gained full-blown independence. You write these states are the international community's prenatal ward. So what does it take for a country to become a new state? East Timor, I guess, most of the people in the world just felt that it had been given a raw deal.
Yes, they tend to follow different paths, but there's two general schools of thought about what makes a state a state. The first one would be that it's simply recognized by other more established states. And the second one is the path that the countries that I've been looking at took, which is just to act like a state and to send out ambassadors, to have a foreign policy and enter into relationships with other states, so that after a while, after acting like a state, you're eventually de facto recognized as one, and then almost as an afterthought that you get that status in multilateral organizations like the United Nations. In the case of East Timor, it was, yes, a history of a raw deal, and then eventually a United Nations authority, and then a bit more. You find other places, though, where that strategy has not worked out quite as well, such as Kosovo, which continues to have a United Nations presence and which seems right now to be stuck at recognition by just, I believe, 60-odd countries, which is, I think, just a bit more than what Taiwan has had, and that hasn't done Taiwan that much good at getting international recognition.
Is that because Kosovo is seen as a client state of the United States?
Yes, that's a big part of it. If you are a limbo state and you don't have the backing of one of the great powers, as Abkhazia does from Russia, for example, then it's going to be very, very difficult for you to get much further. Abkhazia has the backing right now of Nicaragua, Venezuela, Russia, and the minuscule Pacific Island nation of Nauru. So having these countries as your friends is not going to be enough. If you have, for example, Georgia and, by extension, the United States fighting against you.
Well, what were the reasons given for the breakaway, the creation of the Republic of Abkhazia, which declared its independence from Georgia in 1999?
Abkhazia, as they say, had a history of autonomy. So they were able to point to a period before the Soviet era when it actually did exist very comfortably as a country of its own. On top of that, in the 1990s and the late 1980s, you found some troubling statements from the Republic of Georgia that suggested that Abkhazian citizens would not be not exactly be full partners in the Republic of Georgia as it was coming to be formed. So when that happened, there got to be a very unpleasant, as most of them are, ethnic war between the Georgians and the Abkhazians.
Is there some irony in the fact that Russia is supporting Abkhazia but then has fought a brutal war against a breakaway region of its own in Chechnya?
Yes, there's definitely an irony in that, and the shoe is frequently on the other foot. Chechnya would be only one case of an area inside the borders of Russia that wants to be a limbo state with the same kind of status as Abkhazia, or more. You also find Tuva is a member of the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, the UNPO, which is the sort of equivalent of a UN for limbo states, as are the Crimean Tatars and some others too.
Tuva, it was the source of some really beautiful stamps when I was a stamp collector. So it had been a country on its own. Now, what is it, part of Inner Mongolia or Outer Mongolia?
Well, it's still part of the Russian Federation, but you're right. It's right on the edge of Kazakhstan and Mongolia, and I remember produce those beautiful diamond shaped stamps.
Another Georgian breakaway area is South Ossetia, also supported by the Russians.
Yes, and we all probably remember the war very recently between Russia and Georgia over South Ossetia. And that was a conflict that almost perfectly illustrates one of the problems with these limbo states, which is that when two established countries fight each other, they use these states as battlegrounds. And the states, for their own purposes, are often very interested in having independence. But independence does not suit the purposes of the two states that surround them, in the case of South Ossetia or in Abkhazia, where some say that war almost took place.
Well, Bill Gates seems to have recognized these states, because Spellcheck will tell you about spelling Abkhazia a Somaliland or Ossetia, which I found interesting. Abkhazia was once a vacation resort for Soviet leaders, but you write that, unlike Abkhazia, Somaliland did not exactly enchant me as a place beautiful enough to die for.
And, you know, Abkhazia, even today, is a really wonderful place to visit. I'm sometimes accused by my friends of sounding like a PR agent for the Abkhazian Ministry of Tourism, but it truly is beautiful. It's got a subtropical coastline. It has palm trees. It has snow-capped mountains. None of these things are available in Somaliland, although there are some nice things about Somaliland, but I wouldn't be able to point to much of the natural geography as a draw for the place.
Well, would it even exist if there weren't so much chaos in Somalia?
It would be difficult to come up with a justification for its existence if the alternative weren't so awful. The southern part of Somalia is a failed state, really, without peer. So to ask for the country or limbo state of Somaliland to join up with their brothers to the south would be really going a bit too far. That in Somaliland, they have a democratic process. They have order and security. In Somalia, southern part, you have none of that. So it really is, in a way, I would hate to say it, a lucky break for them that there is so much chaos in the south. Gives them a very, very good excuse for existing.
Can you tell us a little about Khalistan?
Khalistan is a Sikh separatist state, and unlike the ones that I've described already, it doesn't really have any territory of its own, and it sort of represents the on the end of the spectrum of limbo states that is the opposite from, say, Taiwan, which has all the organs of the state. It has military and security apparatus, whereas Khalistan, really, it's political head. I see eating cheap Chinese food in a restaurant near my office alone now and then, and that is pretty much what the government consists of, is that guy.
Well, there are any number of separatist movements in India, but no real separatist states. What would you call Tibet?
Tibet is a member of the organization I described earlier, the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization, and it's another good example of a place that's somewhere in this continuum between Khalistan and Taiwan, but probably closer to the Khalistan end of that spectrum. It doesn't have much formal recognition, but it certainly does have people who at least claim to speak for it as a country.
Should I assume that members of the international community are reluctant to recognize breakaway regions as new countries for fear that it might provide incentives for other revolutionary movements, including breakaways within their own countries?
Yes, if you start saying that anyone who acts like a state is a state, then you do, if you're a recognized country, make yourself hostage to anyone inside your borders who's able to start waging a foreign policy. And that explains a lot of the reluctance that established countries have had to recognize states, even states that, like Somaliland, for example, seem to have very, very good reasons to have separated. that's really the main reason why you would be reluctant to recognize them, is that you'd be afraid that someone within your own borders would come up with the same idea.
Did the Montevideo Convention establish the theory of what makes a state?
Well, there have been many theories, but the Montevideo Convention is one event that is pointed to by these limbo states because it was particularly particularly keen on the idea that you would be able to call yourself a state if you acted like a state. So it's frequently pointed to by the limbo states as, look, this is something that we've all sort of agreed to, and we should take it to heart and recognize places like Kurdistan, Somaliland, Abkhazia.
Well, would these states be able to survive if they weren't also client states of richer nations?
I think they probably could. They tend to be in very bad neighborhoods, so survival is, I suppose, a sort of relative term. But Abkhazia and Kurdistan certainly have enough within their own borders to keep themselves afloat economically. And politically, they've done a fairly good job of navigating hostile waters. So if they were, by some massive change of heart internationally, recognized, then they could probably hold their own. But of course, that's a long way away, and many minds would have to change.
Graham Wood is a staff editor at The Atlantic magazine. His article on quasi-states around the world is in the current issue of another magazine, Foreign Policy Magazine, and I'm very pleased that he talked with us again on our show today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.